Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Dennis Bro.
And Dennis, it's great to see you. I last saw you only last Northern summer, which was really nice. We were in Norway, one of the great climate criminal countries of the world, along with Australia. And we talked then about various topics, and I was thinking then about restarting the podcast, and you're one of the first people I wanted to invite. I've got a basic question I ask everybody, but I wonder if we could begin actually with something you'd mentioned as a slight career review on your part.
Sure. Yeah. so, since this is a podcast that does take up cultural studies has been really important to me, probably the background for my academic work. And it started with my thesis, which was, I think, the second longest thesis at NYU, called Outside the Law, Labor and the Crime Film, 1941 to 50. People, Thompson et al., and they were extremely important to me in mapping out the position of working class people, the working class in that formation called film noir, particularly during the war, where it was oppositional, and afterwards, where it was for a spell dominant, and then where it was repressed with the things like the House Un-American Activities Committee. You know, I then went on to write a book because I thought, this is not just an American phenomenon, and too often film noir is American. And so it has almost a kind of imperial projection of a formation that is anything but. So I wanted to talk about film noir in other countries before the American domination, and found out that after World War II, it was really, with a combination of 30s gangster films and crime films, and then the country's own kind of noirish background and working class, which particularly came from the cultural front in France, and then was transferred in Italy and Japan, in China, in Germany after World War II. So that's a book that's called Class Crime and International Film Noir. And so then I wrote a book about the art world, because I wanted to talk about how after World War II and the Cold War, called Cold War Expressionism, Perverting the Politics of Perception. And it's also called, it's subtitled Blacklists and Blockades in the Postwar Art World. And it's about how this sort of, in a way, media offensive around abstract expressionism, not the abstract expressionists themselves, but the way their work was interpreted, was a sort of State Department kind of fluff designed to eliminate the working class formation of popular art in the 30s, and also in direct competition to Mexican muralism, which was its challenger at the time, yeah, which it defeated in 1950. And then I decided, I've always loved television. So I decided, and I grew up watching a lot of television. And, somebody said, how can you watch so much of that crap? And I don't know, but I not
you
only
did.
like
I'm an American. It's my damn birthright. What are you talking
that's
about?
Right. What are you talking about? What? I grew up with crap. I'm very used to it. I love crap. Anyway, I started writing about television, and I did write a book on Maverick, on the television series Maverick, about Roy Huggins, who is the producer, and about Huggins' role as kind of an iconoclast and an outsider throughout television, who opened up a lot of television, actually, and brought at least a kind of left liberal sort of sensibility, particularly in Maverick, who was a Western hero who didn't use a gun, didn't like fighting, and was essentially, kind of a con man and gambler. And so, you know, it was a really different kind of hero and so different from what was on at the time, the 50s Cold War Westerns like Gunsmoke. In fact, they did a really good parody of Gunsmoke in which they had the you know, the opening of Gunsmoke with the duel, and it was shot from Marshall Dillon's rear. And made him look really funny. Anyway, I read that, and then I decided, well, you know, I really want to talk about contemporary television. So I wrote a book using the French theorist Bernard Stiegler, and I at that point I was starting to move to France, where I live now, and I wrote a book called "Birth of the Binge: Serial TV and the End of Leisure." Kind of strange title, because everyone else is predicting there's more leisure, you know. But for working class people, we're seeing the end of leisure. So there were two sensibilities. Although, you know, things have moved now, and now we're seeing the end of leisure for middle class people also. You know, they're coming for you. You know, as I once had a student who said, "You know, Professor Bro, I'm just not that interested in history." And I said, "Well, you know what? History's interested in you." And interested in it. Anyway, and that was a book that was for the first time used Stiegler in the field of television studies and brought that into the fold. And then I wrote a book on my I became a t then I just became a television critic for a year because I'd always wanted to do that. And I wrote practically every week on television series. And this was the time of the pandemic when there was nothing else going on. So it was even legitimate to watch a lot of television. Nobody was doing anything else.
Finally, your birthright became legit.
That's right. So, and that book is called Diary of a Digital Plague Year. Because one of the major things was the Daniel Defoe book, which I read and found very enlightening and topical, unfortunately, you know. So I wrote that, and since then I've been working in terms of books. I've been working in a different direction, but still the same direction in a way. And I've been writing novels. I really love the film noirs from the 40s. They are still kind of my first love. So my novels are four novels so far, and I'm in Los Angeles, you know, researching the fifth, and they are about a detective named Harry Palmer, which I guess English people know from A Different Guise, but and his and
Although in the initial books, he's never named.
that's
He's
good. So,
in the Ipcress file. In the films, he's always known as Harry Palmer. But
yeah.
in the original book of the Ipcress file, he is without a name.
That is very good because, you know, I didn't, that people say, "Oh, you stole the name." And I didn't. I stole it from a friend of mine who's very funny. And his name is something is quite similar to that. So I thought, you know, outlook on the world that's quite like my friend, actually. So that's where it actually came from.
Right.
Anyway, so what I've done is I've looked at, you know, four aspects. Each book has a central aspect to it, and mostly it centers on an industry that the detective Harry and now his secretary and later partner Crystal become involved with. And the first one is about the Blacklist, 1947, and it's called Left of Eden. And, you know, Gunnar Stålsson, who writes noirs, and he's called the Scandinavian Raymond Chandler, and he wrote that, you know, this is the first time I've seen anyone deal directly with in noir with the question of the Blacklist. But you know what? If you read The Long Goodbye, Chandler is secretly talking about the Blacklist all the way through. And there's a tortured writer who just doesn't know what to do with himself, you know, and who's tortured by his past, you know, but can't recognize where that torture is coming from. It's replete with the imagery of the repression that Chandler's it's really discussing, you know, at some point practically openly, actually. Anyway, So that was the first one. The second one is about, it's called A Hello to Arms, and it's about the arms industry after World War II. And it raises the question, why in a time of peace, when there was really no threat on the horizon, did the U.S. defense budget triple? And what was the reason for that? And Harry gets involved with it. And he also gets involved with the campaign, the presidential campaign of Henry Wallace, because there's a mole on the inside, and they ask Harry to find the mole. And there's a very interesting answer to who the mole is that involves some, well, nebulous pillow talk, let's say. And the third one is called The Precinct with the Golden Arm, and that deals with that subject that's almost that you cannot talk about LA without dealing with, and that's the LAPD. The LAPD, and the other thing that it deals with, there's almost always a contemporary ring to the books, because of course we have a huge arms budget now. And also that the second one dealt with African Americans in the arms industry. The third one deals with Mexican Americans in Boyle Heights. And drugs coming into the neighborhood, and the question is, where are they coming from? And two rogue or renegade cops who are, sort of policing Boyle Heights. the third one is called The House That Buff Built, and that's the current book, and that's about the housing crisis in Los Angeles and how it can be traced back to 1950, a time when Los Angeles, instead of building, choosing not to build public housing, gave millions of dollars back to the government rather than build public housing, because institutions like the Los Angeles Times thought that that would really disturb landholders and the building industry. So they deliberately set out, they knocked out the mayor who was in favor of public housing, and they completely reversed the policy after World War II, actually leaving, this is the beginning of, as we were just talking about homelessness in LA, this is the beginning of the homelessness crisis.
And it's also, I mean, incidentally, but also importantly, the moment when the University of Southern California, or to use its technical title, the University of Spoiled Children, has an urban planning group that is made of basically shills for the real estate sector. And UCLA has a bunch of architects who are on the left who are fired.
That's really
Who are
interesting.
fired.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, because USC here is like Columbia and NYU in New York. I mean, they are the primary pro they're one of the primary property holders in the state. I have a friend, David James, who is at USC, and I wrote a thing on this guy who was on he's on the USC board, who ran for mayor. What was the name? Richard. I can't remember. He got defeated, but he presented himself as a man of the people who was on the USC board. He was on every major board, and presented himself as an outsider who just wanted to do good. Anyway, they defeated him. They
Well,
didn't.
I mean, interrupting for a moment, when we were both at NYU, the letterhead, you'll recall, said New York University, a private university in the public service. And Stanley Aronowitz used to say, no, it's a public university in the private service. It gets all this public money, which it then basically hands over to its trustees.
Yes, that's right. That's a great description, actually.
Is.
Stanley just died, and we miss him. And okay, so now I'm in LA starting the next book, which is called The Dark Ages. So Harry returns to the blacklist, only now in full swing in 1951, what Dalton Trumbo had called the time of the toad, where everybody was in the business of turning everybody else in. And a friend you had yesterday was no longer your friend today. And you know what? One of the things it talks about is the sort of complexity in the Jewish Americans in LA, and particularly in the movie industry, where you have kind of these two sides. You have John Howard Lawson, the noted, communist on the one side, and you have a mayor, the head of MGM, on the other. And they're really polar opposites, in terms of who they are, so there's a great division. But the other thing is about the cutting off of freedom of speech, and I guess We've seen that because when we were in Oslo, our compatriot Jody Dean has now been released from Hobart College. And there's a petition backing this because she wrote an article about Israel. There's nothing inflammatory about the article. It's simply really an article talking about where the situation is right now. But we're in a place again where where blacklists are sort of being instituted. So I
No.
think this is
Dennis,
19
I didn't
people
know that.
are
I recently recorded a podcast with Jody, and I
just
actually asked her,
happened. Yeah.
oh my God, I cannot believe this. I mean, I can, but I cannot.
It's striking. It's striking. And you know, it's one of those, you know, it's the thing like HUAC, it's a high profile firing designed to scare people, you know, as well as, of course, she's lost her, you know, she
Oh.
can't teach, you know.
This is Dennis is referring to the House Un-American Activities Committee, which Bobby Kennedy was a leading light on, if we can use that expression, or was a counsel to. And it was the congressional institutionalization of the attempt to destroy the left in the United States.
It
And
was, yes, left and also liberals. It was an attempt to destroy the left and to scare anyone who had progressive ideas into being silent, you know. And in some ways we're back in that situation, I have to say. I mean, it's very scary. Anyway, so the other thing is, you know, I teach also. I taught at the Sorbonne. I taught television studies in the master's program at the Sorbonne. I taught writing cultural critique and writing cultural articles in the École Supérieure de Journalisme, and I just finished teaching a course in literature of minorities at Nanterre, Paris 10, Paris 10. And you know, I've got to say, if you want to get around these restrictions, a great class to teach is literature of minorities. I taught it in English, and it's all, you know, of the United States, minority literature. Because, you know, I have a tendency sometimes to be sort of to be didactic, especially when I get to the current. And, you know, in teaching that class, you don't have to make any statements about what the US is, where it comes from, and how it treats people. You
Yeah.
just have to read the literature. And they
Absolutely.
make the statements for themselves. And they'll make the current leap easily also. It's a very interesting subversive class, you
Yeah,
know.
beautiful.
So,
So
anyway.
I want, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. And I'm also a journalist now. So I do write. God, I write for nine different publications, two radio stations, one in France and the Pacifica radio station in the US, and a daily newspaper in Britain, and like about four websites and two journals now. I write for Monthly Review Online and for Jump Cut. I have an article in the current issue of Jump Cut on the business of television. And I have one that'll be coming up in the next one in 2025, and it's on the paper that I gave in Oslo on climate catastrophe and apocalyptic television series. Don't worry, be glum. So, and I'll be you know, sort of revising that, and I'm giving a paper also in Turkey in is the next conference. On called reactionary reflexivity on contemporary media and how what was a sort of fun thing at the dawning of postmodernism has atrophied and become something quite different now as we watch one media outlet simply pinging to another and all of it staying within what they call the Overton window, you know, of what's possible to express. So there you go.
A busy boy. We share
Busy.
many things in common, Dennis. And I remember my friend Graham Turner saying to me of one of my ex-wives, I knew it would never last when you told me she didn't like television.
Yeah. By
But
the
I wanted to mention the
way,
nuance.
I just want to say something. I live very happily. My wife is Indonesian, and so I watch you know, American and European and Australian television, and she's a chef, but every time she's home, all she's doing is watching Chinese television. So.
Really great, beautiful. And I've just watched the first three episodes of Sugar
Oh, I
on
liked it very much.
Apple TV, which got a terrible review in The Guardian, but which I like quite a lot. And apart from anything else, it has these beautiful diegetic slash extra diegetic inserts from classic noir,
Yes.
like Gilda and Double Indemnity and so on. And I
He
worry
loves.
that it may become overly conspiratorial. The third episode ended that way a bit for me. But I think Colin Farrell is great in it, and the other lead and supporting actors are superb. So
Yes, I really like it a lot, actually. There's one point at which he's got on the television the Great Train Robbery. So
is that what it is?
neon
Yes.
noir. Yeah, it's
Okay.
the cowboy. It's the insert shot from the Great Train Robbery where the cowboy's shooting.
Okay.
Loves Glenn Ford.
I love the part when he settles the drunken former singer down in her lapsed state, and also the bit when he settles the dog down that he's adopted in order to watch television.
Yeah, the character is very interesting because, I mean, well, we can't go too much into it because, okay, you might say he's a perfect sort of Democrat, but he's a very, very nice guy, extremely nice, to the point that we haven't seen that type of character who's so interested in, he's isolated but interested in anyone who or any creature that he encounters, but
Absolutely.
he's also very violent. There can be,
He can be
we always have.
violent when inverted commas required, but he says he doesn't
Yes.
like it, he doesn't want a gun, and it's quite clear that everybody around him can't understand him or wants to control him, and he is deeply problematic and flawed, like any great noir hero. I also wanted to ask you, get back to
His
Charlie.
line is, I don't want to hurt you. That's what he always says just before he hurts somebody, because of course this is American television and he does eventually have to hurt somebody. So,
In every episode. I've been working recently on snobbery in Ian Fleming's work, because on the one hand, these things are exemplifications of snobbery, both the novels and the films. But Fleming, whilst clearly being snobbish himself, attacks snobbery very often in the novels, quite overtly, and associates it with, what he regards as the kind of mixed race nature of Bond's great enemies, and is also referring to it as something that is within all of us, but we should learn to control. So anyway, that was sort of interesting to me. But for part of that,
This is a great class character of snobbery, I
oh,
mean.
incredible. And I found a wonderful little essay by Virginia Woolf where she explains that she tries to give herself more cultural capital than she has in order to dine with people like Arnold Bennett and H.G. Wells and Shaw. But the point of this is to say that there's a really interesting conversation between Chandler and Fleming, which you're probably familiar with, where Fleming realizes that he really is in the presence of great literature via Chandler, and that's not what he is. And I guess for me, in all the things you're talking about, all the writers, all the films, the great writer is Chandler. And for me, he is akin to Shakespeare in terms of truly brilliant English writing, really incredible.
It's true. And Chandler, of course, himself had this complex that his writing was never great literature. He was always out to achieve that which he was already achieving, because no one recognized it, because he started in the pulps, and it's
Sure.
and recognition kind of came later. Although I have to say, The Long Goodbye, there's no way you can read The Long Goodbye and not just think this is great literature. No matter the genre, no matter the genre,
Well, and I think the other thing is, of course, like Dickens, most of these things were not written as novels. I mean, I think Lady in the Lake is maybe the only one that is a novel qua novel. They're little short stories sort of clumped together.
Yes, and a lot of the novels, yes, are expansion of the short of a short story, something that
Yeah,
appeared in a short story and
interesting.
then became a novel. Yeah. And it's interesting because The Long Goodbye, Altman's Long Goodbye, he goes to Mexico to encounter Terry, his friend. but not in the novel, actually. I think Altman made an improvement there, because that trip to Mexico is very, very interesting, actually.
That's the
And
version with Elliot Gould.
that's the version with Elliot Gould, yeah.
I've never seen a character smoke as much as Elliot Gould's character does.
Or, I mean, he was the original mumblecore. He
He
started
was. It's
mumblecore
worse
there.
than Brando, actually. It's
You
very hard to
can't
understand him.
understand a single word he says, and it totally works. The thing is, my character actually, what's going on in the Dark Ages, what Harry eventually finds out is somebody's killing writers. And he says, what on earth would anyone want to kill a writer for? Not for their money, that's for sure. But somebody is. And he goes to Mexico to this colony of where the blacklistees are, and to see them. And well, something tragic happens in Mexico that is, he believes, is his fault. So then he comes back to LA, really dedicated, well, at first sorrowful, and then really dedicated to actually trying to figure out who what's going on here. But the other thing is, in Mexico, there's a, I like to have cameos in my books. So they encounter Luis Buñuel, because there were two blacklistees in Mexico who wrote two of Buñuel's films, Robinson Crusoe, and I can't remember the other one, but Buñuel had them working on his films, actually. A bit of revenge, because of course Buñuel was bounced from MGM, so here he has his own stall of Hollywood writers who are writing for him in Mexico,
That's a
Blacklist.
wonderful, wonderful story. So, in terms of your novels, Prof. D, you mentioned you're in LA doing research, and I very much appreciate that, we're having this conversation at what's now 2:30 in the morning for you. What's the research process like for you in terms of Harry's character, the things he encounters? Is it that you have a story mapped out roughly? And then you do the research in order to come up with, descriptions and problems and dialogue. How does it work?
So I give myself a month here just to sort of walk in the footsteps of the characters, even though, of course, everything's changed. But it does help to walk, because there is a, what Lipsitz calls a materials memory that exists, and that memory could be a working class memory, it could be a middle class, it could be anything, but it really does help. Like in the last book, The Town of Torrance, so I took a ride out to Torrance and walked the city for about 3 or 4 hours, and it was very useful, actually. Torrance was a very enclosed racist town in 1950, and it was just on the border of starting to be perhaps opened up, So yeah, so I have a general idea, and then I just sort of follow my impulses. Tomorrow I'll sit down and have my first real research period. So I'll see where to go, and then if I usually will find some place, a museum or something, and I'll immediately go there. One that was really helpful for the LAPD was the police museum. It was hilarious. I'm on the outside. Nobody knows about it. It's right on the edge of the valley. Oh yeah, it was interesting too. The museum is what is a police former police station that was a jail. So this was, when I went there, was just before Halloween. So they were the police the jails, which were where Mexicans were beaten, were all decorated with ghouls and goblins, and you could come in on Halloween and spend some time in the jail. I mean, oh my God, but it was, you had to have gone and seen it, and seen how the police look at themselves, and that was really, really useful,
Of
actually.
that. I mean,
So.
I think about some of the great, in inverted commas, contemporary noir films, Chinatown, L.A. Confidential, and a failure, but politically very interesting, The Two Jakes. And one of the things that they have in common is that they understand corruption as being at the heart of LA, of contemporary white dominated LA. They understand what every Angeleno understands, which is the Department of Water and Power runs the city, and it does so in the interests of big business. And they understand that real estate runs the city, obviously, in the interests of big business. And I think one of the reasons why that kind of fiction, and in the contemporary idiom, one thinks of Michael Connelly, obviously, as another very successful writer. His insider stuff is really about having been a police a journalist covering the cops, and he has lots of cops who tell him stuff. And
Yeah, unfortunately, I would say embedded with, but okay.
no, I mean, and that's right, embedded with. But even there, even in Connolly, you get a sense of the corruption at the heart of LA. Maybe
Yes.
not amongst the cops so much, although there's a bit of that in those novels, but big time in terms of what they're dealing with. And
Yeah,
it's
you
the
know.
underside that I think you're investigating again and again in these novels. But and of course it's across the United States, but really Southern California is where we find so much of it.
Yeah, you know, as you know, Baudelaire was really clear about this. Baudrillard, you know, that you know, it's the place where you see the savagery of American capitalism, you know, and it's always on display. You know, people say to me in Europe, "Why on earth are you going to L.A.? We go to San Francisco," you know, and I say, "Yeah, well, yes, I know. I mean, I like San Francisco, but the sav I go to L.A. for the savagery. That's why, you know."
Well,
And that kind of
you
okay.
mentioned Baudelaire there by mistake for Baudrillard, but Baudelaire was the guy who recognized what he called Americanization as being the tendency to look for the value of everything in accounting terms. And so I don't think you get a Baudrillard without a Baudelaire for that matter.
It's probably true. Yes, that's true. Yep. By the way, I used Baudelaire in Maverick because I have a chapter on Maverick as flaneur because the
Lovely.
way he
I
treated
must
the
admit,
world was quite different than any other cowboy.
I've read your other academic books, but I haven't read The Maverick. Do you mention Roger Moore's character at all?
A little bit. I wasn't so. I was really interested in Garner,
The
you
James
know.
Garner character. Yeah,
James
sure.
Garner really is Maverick, you know. And then the show got kind of disrupted. The studio was never really Warner Brothers was never really that comfortable with it because they had all these other Westerns which were on the air, and this one they always thought this one was laughing at them because it was laughing at them, you know, very much, you know. So in the end, Huggins went on to other shows, you know. And the next show he went on to, by the way, he went on to another contract in Universal. Warner's was absolutely the worst in television. When Maverick, there was an extremely interesting pitching session where Huggins came in and pitched 77 Sunset Strip and Maverick. And these are two shows which create a whole constellation of two genres which will people television for like the next 8 years. Okay, this is how Warner's treated him in gratitude. They said, so then he wrote the pilots to 77 Sunset Strip and Maverick. And they were both hugely successful. And 77 Sunset Strip did the same thing to the detective film. All of a sudden, the detective film was about sexy guys and girls in pleasurable places. The Americans went, wait a minute, there's no pleasure. It's all grim. You know, you can't have pleasure. And it was just a completely different thing. But what Warner Brothers did was for 77 Sunset Strip, they opened it in a theater somewhere in Asia, you know, before the show. And they said, so this is really a movie. So Roy Huggins doesn't have the credit for this because this is a movie that's done by Warner Brothers, not by Roy Huggins. So he never got the created by credit on it. Maverick, it was much worse. There's a in the in the in what was the pilot? What Huggins wrote as the pilot. There's a story about a lodestone in a mine and how they're you know and how they're digging in a mine in one place and it accrues to someone else. So Warner Brothers bought the novel that the story appeared in. The story is about 5 minutes of the show, and they said, "Well, we own the rights to this, not you, so you're not going to get the created by credit here." So when he went to Universal, The first thing he did was win for writers the idea of the created by, which was really important in television, and of course is what's fueled the whole showrunner thing today, you know.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that history. I
That
must
had to
admit,
be one.
beg your pardon?
That had to be one from the
Yeah,
studios.
okay, I get it. God, that well, they've always been bastards. They always will be. I must admit that you've fated me to a day with 77 Sunset Strip, da 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 da, running through my head. So I can't thank you for that, Dennis. But nevertheless,
It will run through your head for a couple of weeks, so just get used to
well,
it.
I've got one to throw back at you that's terrible, that will destroy your mind and mean you can't sleep after this talk, which is Flipper.
Okay.
Okay, theme music to Flipper.
And I always remember, and always, I always remember the noises that they really had those accurate dolphin noises. Those were all over the place all the time. They're always in the background. You know,
So
they
I've
couldn't
got you
go
back, but
anywhere.
I've done it deliberately, whereas you did it to me accidentally.
Well,
Dennis, I wanted to
I
ask
want
about
to say one other thing too, and that's the thing about the contemporary aura in the novel. So people say to me when they read them, they go, "Hey, how come this sounds so much like the present?" Because I don't do anything that isn't in the past, but it resounds so heavily in the present because these are conflicts that have never been resolved in LA,
No,
you know.
never, never, never.
And so they do resound, and you know, there's always a present thing. And people say, "Well, how do you do that?" And the way that I do that in the research is I'll pick an area and I'll stay contemporary with it, and I'll read everything in the contemporary that's going on, you know, like Boeing at the time of the of a Hello to Arms with the arms industry, you know, what's going on there, that corruption, the drug thing with the drugs hitting the streets from the medical, you know, laboratories. Now just the whole thing of like the silencing, the media silence, and the silencing of, you know, sort of real left-wing voices, you know.
I mean, one, we were talking before we started recording, as you said, Dennis, about the housing issue in LA. And when I lived in LA, I started out living on the West Side, where you nice left Jewish liberals didn't have to confront this. The big transformation now is that there are encampments of homeless people absolutely everywhere, including in those wealthy and liberal neighborhoods of very decent people, but who didn't have to look at this day in, day out. And there are pop-up everythings all over LA, pop-up brothels on the street. When I left the West Side and went to live downtown, I wanted something that was different, because really the only thing I enjoyed about the West Side was the beach, because I'm a beach bum at heart. Downtown, things would happen like you'd walk down the street and someone would just punch you. Or people would draw guns.
You know, yeah, and also you see the results of the fentanyl crisis right now downtown, you know, and you understand where the idea for things like The Walking Dead came from. Because when you're in downtown LA, you are faced with this kind of, you know, this gentrifying impulse, which is actually positive. With there's a lot of artists. You know, they say there's more galleries and artist spaces in Los Angeles than any place in the world. Anyway, you know, but you're also faced with this detritus, you know, of people walking around. And you know what? It's gotten more and more dangerous. You know, also to be in LA, no matter where you are. And there's a show, it's called From. I don't know if you know this show or not, but it's
No.
got the black actor who was one of the lead actors in Lost. And the story of From is that people land in this place and they don't know how they've landed there. And the thing about it is you can't go out at night, because if you do go out, there's these flesh-eating zombies that will get you. But they approach you as if they're regular persons, and then they eat your flesh. Well, you know, I mean, honestly, all you have to do is walk around downtown LA, and that's From. And if you're out at night, it's getting increasingly more dangerous to be out at night, you know.
I mean, it's such a tragedy because you mentioned that artist's world. And of course, to get to that artist's world from the center of LA or the West Side, you basically have to go through the biggest encampment of homeless people in the global north. You can't really skirt it very easily, right?
Yes. I mean, when I started coming here in 2019 to do research, and it was like you're on the buses and you're going by the bridges. So you look and you go, oh my God, there's a whole encampment under the bridges. But then the movement has been out from the bridges and onto the street, And of course, it also makes it's also transportation things. For a long time, you say, why does the LA Metro not reach places? It doesn't reach places because the homeless are contained downtown around the Bowery and they don't want them traveling. That was the whole thing about having a metro that went to the beach, Santa Monica. They said, oh my God, they're going to ride out here and we'll be overcome,
Well, you remember the arguments were that digging the metro out there would mean that you could potentially set off explosions because of gas that was stored underground on, as a consequence of petroleum exploration. And of course, the interesting thing is now you can get to the beach from downtown,
Yes, you can.
but it involves one of the most spectacular public mass transit trips I've taken anywhere in the world. You start off underground, then you become a tram, and then basically you're on a monorail high above the city. I mean, it's a bizarre transformation that the thing goes through.
Yes.
And one of the other things about mass transit in LA that remains fascinating to me, because I gave up my car when I lived in LA as part of some sort of commitment I was making. And as you know, there are several different bus lines in Los Angeles. The orange bus line, which is, goes everywhere, is basically taken by poor African Americans and Latinos and homeless people. And I would be the only white person not homeless ever on that line. Whereas the metro, everybody takes, and actually tourists take. You know, it's there are these cultural boundaries that are set up in LA implicitly that people understand and abide by. And so I don't know what it's like right now. You're there on the ground, but the violence in my time was on the orange buses, and it would often be, you know, homeless guy on homeless guy, for example.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of that sort of acting out on the public transports, it's anger by people who've been left by the system because and they get a chance to it erupts on these public spaces. But yeah, it's quite amazing. Yeah, it's incredible. And this whole sort of thing was, I mean, it can be traced back to, there's a great book called Thinking Big by Robert Gottlieb. About the Los Angeles Times and how the Los Angeles Times and the real estate industry essentially established almost all of modern Los Angeles, where to build, what to build, that northern downtown was what was going to be developed. The bulldozing of Bunker Hill, which is the site of so many film noirs, they're always walking through these areas. And I love that John Fante. That's what he writes about so eloquently. The high idea of this whole area just bulldozed. The only thing that's left is what's it called? The Angel's Heart or whatever, the where you go up the little thing. But that's you go up the little hill. But that hill used to be completely populated. It's all gone now. All bulldozed
Oh,
to build.
Angel's Lift,
Or,
Angel's Ride.
in, yeah, yeah. It's in the opening of one of the of oh of Perry Mason. Of Perry
It's in
Mason.
Perry Mason, and it's in a crucial place for a murder in the Bosch series
Yes, he uses it too. Yes,
on
that's
Amazon.
Yeah,
Angel
but
Flight, Angel Flight.
Angel Flight. Yeah, that's all that's left, of what was Bunker Hill, a sort of thriving place where, yes, it was, kind of what we might call some SROs or whatever, but it was a place where you had working bohemians, working class artists. You also had a lot of Mexicans who were coming to LA who were needing a place, not getting paid, and they chose to live that way. But they were all gotten out and
They've all gotten
in.
out. Well, think of Dodger Stadium. You know,
Yes,
when
well.
coaxial cable comes in and it becomes feasible to expand baseball across the Rockies because you can suddenly get primetime audiences. And so the Dodgers and the Giants leave Brooklyn. One goes to LA, one to San Francisco. Where is their beautiful stadium? It's in a really important Mexican American, Chicano, Chicana space of living.
That's right. Three communities which had each their own names, and the real estate industry renamed it Chavez Ravine because it had a nicer sounding. But it's got sort of the sound of being Mexican without really being Mexican, so it doesn't scare anybody, But nobody knows that Chavez Ravine is a renaming of the three communities which were really embedded in the area, in which they completely got out. I went to Dodger Stadium in 2019 to see a game. I'm a big Dodgers fan, but I walked, you walk around the stadium and they have all the photos of the moment when they were there, when they were thinking of coming in and coming in, And there's this photo. It's completely a barren area, and it says this area was completely empty, and the Dodgers came and built this stadium. No photo, not the famous photo of the woman being torn out of her house, but a complete rewriting of history. And I guess you could say sort of like Gaza today, that there were no there there are no people there, kind of. So what's the problem,
So, Dennis, I had two more questions for you, if I may. And then after those, I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish. Does that sound okay as a means of concluding?
Sounds good,
The
yeah.
first question is to ask you about the journalism you're doing in so many different outlets. And some of this is screen oriented, but a lot of it is much broader than that. Could you tell us a little bit about that journalism?
Yeah, well, let's see. I guess there's sort of two things that underpin it. My Substack account is called Cultural Politics for Those Who Care, which is, I guess, kind of trying to liberal guilt trip people into subscribing, but it is, that's what it is for. And for those who don't care, they don't need to subscribe. So anyway, and it does deal with cultural politics, and then, I've always had this idea that there are two sides to writing about cultural formations, and they often the twain does not meet. One is the simple economic and business side, and the other is the aesthetic. And I've always thought that those two really do need to be combined because you can't understand a cultural industry unless you understand it from both perspectives, So that's been one thing that's always fueled what I've done. I go to this thing every year called Series Mania, and they have a forum 3 days of the business. So I write about both, And of course, the current hot topic is AI. What is AI going to do? How is it going to remake the industry?
Yes.
Is there any way that the guilds can actually catch up to it? What on earth does it mean? What are the companies developing in terms of what are the, what the studios can use? How do the studios see themselves as tech barons who would be much better off if they could actually replace everyone? That kind of stuff, So that's a really hot issue, and it's really fun to write about it. But then you see also when you, I, so I write an article, I often write an article about the business, and then I follow it up with an article where I review series. So I just came out with an article that has 18 series. I call it Spring TV Preview, but really it's just sort of a survey of what's on offer, and I do think it's really important to cover it from both perspectives, actually. And that's been something that's underpinned my work in any cultural field, in film, in television, in art, in literature also. I write about books too. And then the other thing is I've become increasingly more overtly political because as the situation just has gotten more and more horrible, as we sit on the verge of potential three nuclear wars, and nothing seems to be halting this drive toward destruction, along with climate destruction, they're imminently linked, so I have a podcast now called I Fought the Law, and I use the Clash film. And somebody did a very good montage of Gaza over the clashes. I Fought the Law, which was their version of that sort of really working class Bobby Fuller Four, song. And I do an opening with a dispatch where I talk about things myself. I had a thing on Zelensky that I think started the podcast, and it was called Socialism or Couture. And it was about the flying Zelensky's dressing, like when he comes, when he comes to the US, he dresses as a in his combat fatigues. When she goes to Paris, she spends $40,000 on the Champs-Élysées, so both are costumes, that's what they are, so I wanted to talk about that. And then I do an interview, and I did it. I did. And actually, they've been putting my interviews up on WBAI. So I did a really good interview with another scholar, Terry Ginsberg. I think you saw her at Oslo.
Sure,
And she
yeah.
writes about oil in the film industry.
Yeah.
That we did a very good interview. I did an interview with Juan Cole, who is a Michigan historian who talks about who knows the Middle East inside and out, has some really interesting ideas about that. And I just did one with this guy who works in the film industry called Vagabond. He's a Puerto Rican activist who's doing a documentary on the Last Poets. And he had some really interesting things to say about, because I call my first part dispatch and the second an interview. And he had, in my dispatch was about called was called Alec Baldwin's Magic Bullet. The idea that somebody killed somebody, and I know, and there might have been a bullet in a gun, but it wasn't me. I didn't fire it, kind of thing. And also, but mainly it was about the sort of, the profit motive on the set, and how the profit motive, when it becomes paramount, endangers the crew, And this guy, Vagabond, made two interesting points. One, that we never think about this, I think, in film studies, but that the money that we see that's budgets, a lot of it is not spent on the screen. It's spent on making the CEOs and the stars comfortable. And that's misspent. That's what, it's his claim. And the other thing is, he has a great idea about it. He said AI called it a plate. He said it's nothing but plagiarism software. That's how he sees it. And he also said, instead of unemploying writers and actors, AI should be talking about getting rid of studio executives. So that was really good. Anyway, so that's, so I've
Beautiful.
kind of gone there. I've got one called, I'm looking for a guest now, and it's called The Cowardly Invincibility of the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. So, so it's becoming more overtly political, but as I feel like I do want to get some of this stuff out, as things just really seem to be moving at a breakneck speed towards real catastrophe. And I'm scared, frankly, to tell you the truth. There's a woman who, there's an interview with this woman who's a Russian, public affairs person. And she said, it's a very interesting comment. She said, I lived in the US for about 3 years, and the overwhelming feeling I got from Americans is fear. And they never acknowledge it. The fear that they are going to lose their job, the fear that they have to work, 100 hours a week in order to just have their position be where it is. Now the fear of what's going to happen, given any one of these hotspots could explode, but you can't read the fear because you're not supposed to buy into it, but it's there everywhere.
There's a really terrific novel called The Vanished Hands by Robert Wilson. I don't know if you know his writing. It's neo-noir, and he's a British novelist resident in Portugal, and he has a re sort of semi-retired US couple who are in complicated ways involved in the novel, and they have this expression that they use about the United States: it's always been fear.
It's interesting.
So my last question to you, Dennis, before throwing to you to add anything you might want, relates to this question of politics, because basically in areas like film and cinema studies, whatever we call it, most people are liberal, at least, I would say. There are very few really reactionary people. And there are very few people who deny the importance of ideology at some level, at least. But you're more radical than most, in part because of your investment in questions of labor and labor not just on screen but off it as well. So I wanted to ask you where that investment came from. Is that something that was familial heritage, personal experience, something you got from reading, listening,
I'm
talking?
Irish. That's where it came from. It came from Ireland. And it, you know, there's just a radical tradition in Ireland. You know, where are they now? You know, they're in the forefront of countries, you know, in terms of standing up for Gaza, you know. And I did have my father was a farmer, had a really a sort of, you know, rural working class background that I came from. So, you know, so I'm kind of a public intellectual. I suppose most people would argue about the intellectual part, but at least I'm anyway, you know, so it's
No, and I
part
think one of the
politics.
things that people don't realize is just how rich the tradition of working class rural radicalism is. In the United States, you can see it in all sorts of places. It's very important in the upper Midwest, in the formation of
Lafont in
workforce.
Wisconsin.
Yep, absolutely. So thank you for sharing that. So, Dennis, to conclude, I'd like, as I said, to pass over to you so you can make any concluding comments you wish.
You know, what I'd like to conclude with is that I'm starting to understand that the genius of Derrida and deconstruction in these times, because as you said, since we're in a liberal consensus, that to want to push things, to make things more sort of radical, right now things are really being policed. And so you know, if you can find the cracks and talk about them, I think that's start to expose them. I think that's really important. I'll give you an example. I was at what's called the Quai de Polar, one of the biggest crime writing conferences, you know, in the world in Lyon. Okay, so this guy who's now a friend of mine, this Italian writer from Parma, writes about his inspector there. He was talking about in the 80s. That he saw a change in the people in Parma with the Reagan Thatcher. It started to interpenetrate into Italian society, and just materiality began to replace just relationships. And he was appalled by it. And that's his subject. That's what he writes about. Okay. So then he turns to the rest of them who are liberals, you know, who are good French liberals, you know, and he says, "So, who runs Europe? What's her name? The woman who's the head of the IMF, a woman who's the head of the European Bank, or the woman who's the head of the European Parliament?" And the other two refused to talk about it. They said they just shook their heads because it was outside of the window. And the moderator said, "Well, okay, we'll come back to you with more questions, but we won't talk about that question again." And isn't that the key question? Who runs Europe? I mean, you know, so that's the way, you know, I think it's interesting to kind of look at the way these things break out and then they're quickly suppressed and to talk about these gaps, actually.
Thank you so much, Dennis. It's always great to learn from you by reading you and listening to you. And today's been terrific. I really appreciate it.
And me too, Toby. Thanks a lot. And I really enjoy your work very, very much, actually. Been very important to my development. So it's great to spend some time with you.